Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Just a quick note that today's episode is going to be a rerun. The next season of the Psychology Podcast will begin later this year. I haven't taken any break in 5 years of doing this podcast, so I thought it was about time to take a step back and think about how I can make this a better experience for you all. Until then, enjoy these episodes from our archives.
Today, it's my great pleasure to have the great Daryl Trefford on the show. Daryl is a psychiatrist who specializes in the development of autism spectrum disorders and Savant syndrome. He is on the staff at St. Agnes Hospital and serves on the board of trustees of Marianne University. Trefford was a consultant to the movie Rain Man, and his latest book is Islands of Genius, The Bountiful Mind of the Autistic Acquired and Sudden Savant. Thank you, Daryl, for talking to me today.
My pleasure to be here.
As you know, I'm a longtime fan, I guess you could say, of your work, and hopefully you'd consider me a colleague as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to ask you why you called your book Islands of Genius.
Well, when I met my first savant, which was way back in 1962, I was simply astounded, frankly, by these first savants were kids on a children's unit, some of whom were severely disabled, and yet had these islands of intactness or islands of genius that stood in such contrast to overall handicap that it just seemed to me that the term island of genius was appropriate for these spectacular abilities in a sea of disability.
Right. So there was just such a huge difference, striking contrast between what they seem to be having difficulties doing in life and their skill set and a different skill set that they seem to be very extraordinary.
Right. Yeah. Some of them were actually mute and had no language whatsoever.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And yet had some spectacular ability. And it just struck me that, what does this say about human potential overall? Well, yeah. Now with the iPad and the talking tablet, we're finding that these kids who are mute and have no expressive language are able to communicate with the talking tablet, and some of them at an astonishing level.
Right. Right. And I remember seeing a very touching video clip. I can't remember if it was Leslie Lemke or not. It was an autistic savant who was blind. He picked up the music very easily, and he didn't talk, but he started singing one day. You know, he was playing music, and his caretaker was just like amazed, absolutely amazed.
Right. And that's true that Leslie, as a matter of fact, he talks somewhat. A lot of it is echolalic, and it's hard to carry on a conversation. But he will sing any tune that he's heard. And as a musical savant, it's a little unusual to find someone who is a pianist but also singing. And Leslie does both.
Right. So I want to ask you a question, because you were the scientific advisor to the movie Rain Man. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the main character in that movie. To what extent was Raymond Babbitt based on a real character?
Well, the film was inspired by Kim Peek, who is what I call the Mount Everest of memory. He simply has the most phenomenal memory of any savant I've ever. It turns out quite by accident that Barry Morrow, who had written two made-for-television programs in the past called Bill, about when Mickey Rooney was playing someone who was cognitively disabled, they just happened to be in the same room at the same time at this convention, and Barry Morrow was simply struck by Kim Peek's memory. They happened to be in a library room, and he was pulling books out and quizzing Kim about them. And so he, on the way back, on the plane back to California, he wrote down autistic savant, and then he went about writing the script for the movie Rain Man, inspired by Kim Peek. But the Raymond Babbitt is a composite savant. It's not the story of Kim Peek. Right. And all the scenes that you see in the movie are based on real life savants. The toothpick scene, memorizing of the phone book, the computing mathematical equations, but not knowing the difference between a candy bar and a sports car. All of those are real life scenes, but Raymond Babbitt is a composite savant rather than the story of Kim Peek.
Right, right. So that's very interesting. So I want to tease apart a couple things here, and that's the difference between autism and savantism. Am I correct in saying they're not the same thing, and they're not always co-occurring?
Yes, that's right.
Could you define each? Would you mind defining each first?
Sure. Savant syndrome is a remarkable but rare condition in which a person has some underlying developmental disability or other brain disorder who has some spectacular island of genius that stands in stark contrast to overall handicap. So savant syndrome by definition means that somebody has an underlying disability and the savant ability is grafted onto that underlying disability. Now, about 70% of the time, savants have autism as the underlying disability, but the other 30% have some other condition. Could be a traumatic brain injury, could be dementia, could be cognitive disability. So not all savants are autistic, and not all autistic persons are savants. And I think one of the things that people come away from the movie saying, oh, I know what an autistic savant is, and they assume that all autistic savants or all autistic persons have the abilities of Raymond Babbitt. And that's not true. About 1 out of 10 persons with autism does have some savant ability, but means 9 out of 10 do not.
So interesting. And I just wonder, like, what kind of traits or characteristics of autism can facilitate savant skills? Because I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence that that most savant skills, virtually all of them, are nonverbal, in the nonverbal domain. Is that right?
Mostly, there are some polyglot savants who do have language abilities, where the ability to speak or to interpret languages is the ability, but that's really quite rare.
Right. So maybe some of these kind of characteristics of autism, like attention to detail, interest in visual spatial reasoning, these sorts of things, might be conducive to extraordinary skill in some
areas. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. I think those that you mentioned, attention to detail, ability to organize and to memorize, massive memory or extraordinary memory is shared as well, and the ability to focus on detail rather than the big picture is certainly a part of autism. And it turns out, as I said, about 1 in 10 persons with autism has savant abilities, but it's about 1 in 1,400 persons with other brain disorders underlying have savant abilities. So it's much more common in autism, and people are trying to find out what is the connection. Why is it 1 out of 10 autistic persons and 1 out of 1,400 others?
Let me flip the script for 1 second here. So there are a lot of things that non-savants, is what some people would call neurotypical individuals, are really good at, but we don't make a big deal out of it because it's just a normally developing thing. So for instance, like most people's social skills, probably a savant looks at those social skills and think they're savants. You know, like savants probably look at non-savants and say, wow, you're a savant in social skills.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it seems to me like, you know, if you spend so much time developing one area to the exclusion of other areas, you can become really good in that area. You know, and like savants show up, and I don't think, and we're going to get to this later, it's not all practice by any means. But, you know, this is sort of attention to detail. There's sort of like, you know, you see in the savant interests that they don't seem to be as interested in some things that most, quote, neurotypical people are interested in. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, that's certainly true, that their interests narrow often to several areas, and they do spend an awful lot of time in those areas, at the expense, frankly, of other things that most of us spend our time with.
So, what do you think of the proposed DSM-5 changes, or not the proposed, the ones that are actually in the new DSM, in regards to autism? I know there's been some controversy surrounding that.
Well, I think we, I think there's some good news and bad news. I think the good news is that there's some attempt to separate communication disorders out from autism, because there are some children with hyperlexia, particularly, that are often diagnosed mistakenly as autistic because of their preoccupation with numbers and letters and so forth. So I think there's been some lack of clarity between communication disorders and children with autism. So I think separating out some of the communicative disorders is a good thing. I think increasingly, though, the DSM tends to keep diluting autism and expanding the definition. I still go back to Leo Kanner's original description of early infantile autism, in which he described all of the characteristics of that condition, and it was fairly narrow in terms of its who would qualify. And we keep expanding that and to where I think autism has lost its specificity.
So that's an interesting thing. That interesting point. You said specificity. So there, even within the savant domain, you go to great pains to differentiate between different kinds of savants to kind of get at that more granular level, right? So you could you maybe outline some of these different types of savants and why you think it's important to differentiate between them, why it matters?
Well, I think in my experience, at least, I divide savants into three groups. And admittedly, these are subjective at this point, and we need to come down with, you know, I'd like to create some specific rationale and criteria. But at this point, the first level are splitter skills, and autistic children or adults many times will have a preoccupation with one thing or another. It may be calendar calculating, it may be remembering birthdays, license plates, other kinds of trivia. And they sort of, people marvel at their ability to know everybody's birthday and remember everybody's birthday. When there's a family reunion, they go around and tell everybody, remember when their birthday was. Those are called splinter skills, and they do occur in persons with autism. The second level is something I call talented level, and this is where a skill becomes even more conspicuous, and generally a single skill like music or art. And it's conspicuous not just in relationship to the disability, but all in the peer group in general, is higher than you would find even in neurotypical youngsters. And then there's a third category called prodigious savants. And these are, it's a high threshold level. And if these persons did not have a disability, we would call them a prodigy or genius. And I used to say there were 25 such people in the world. I'm up to about 100 now. And there's probably many more than we don't know about. But
what are some of the things these people can do? Can you give people concrete examples?
Kim Peake, certainly, with his memory, he had memorized several thousand books. And by memorize, I'm talking about with page numbers included.
Oh, I could do that for breakfast. Are you kidding me? That's nothing.
Of course, I know. Probably more than several thousand, probably. And so his memory was phenomenal. Leslie Lemke is able to play back any song that he hears with a single hearing, and has this repertoire which is endless. If he's heard the piece and you remember how he coded it when he put it into his memory bank, he can pull that out. But he also at one of the concerts in Texas, instead of having him play the piece back that the person had played, we said, Leslie, we want you to play this with the person. And so he waited about, this person started a song he had never heard before, waited about 3 seconds, and then he began to play back what he had just heard, processed it, and was outputting it in his parallel processing with an measured IQ of 58, I think. So,
wow.
And Stephen Wiltshire can go by a helicopter over Manhattan for 45 minutes and then spend the next 3 days drawing what he saw window by window and building by building. And if you want to superimpose a digital photograph on what he saw in the helicopter, it's exactly the same. So there are there are other artists who have that have ability to recreate with such fidelity that after a single viewing, and unlike many other artists, they don't keep going back to the photograph or to whatever they're drawing. And it's a single image, and that's there, you know, permanently.
What do you think is going on there from like a biological, neurological perspective? Do you think you see minimal practice? Is that right? Minimal deliberate practice to get to that level? What do you think is going on there? I know we have kind of different complementary but somewhat different theories about the origins of those things. Maybe let's hear what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think there's two things that seem to be going on with savants at any of these three levels. The first is that there is some brain damage, often in the right hemisphere, but not always. I'm sorry, in the left hemisphere. And then there is a recruitment of some still intact cortical tissue, undamaged cortical tissue. There is a rewiring to that area, and then the release of dormant potential within that area. It's what I call the three R's. So there's brain damage in one area, and then a recruitment of still intact, often right hemisphere ability. But at the same time, and probably by the same factor, there is a damage to the higher level memory circuits, so-called cognitive or semantic memory, with a reliance on more procedural or lower level cortical striatal memory instead of cortical limbic memory. So what you see in the savant is often our right brain skills coupled with this procedural or habit memory, which is very, very narrow.
Well, that's just that dovetails so nicely, actually, with some of my work on implicit learning. The work, we know that striatum is related to the ability to non-consciously soak up patterns.
Right.
So my whole dissertation was on individual differences in implicit learning. Do people differ in this ability? I found they do, and it's independent of IQ.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Now I think of it. There's a, yeah, no, it's a really, in my book on Gifted, I write a lot about your theory and then talk about implicit learning as playing a possible role there. But it still begs the question, like, how much of that is, you know, or maybe some people are kind of like wired in a certain way that that allows for this implicit learning to happen more automatically than others.
Yes,
that's possible. Yeah,
I think that's true, and I think that that there is that difference even in neurotypical persons. I think some, you know, better at those kind of skills than others, but I think in the savant, the memory is as impressive to me as the skill itself, and those are connected. But I think they're two different processes in different areas of the brain that are affected.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions about savantism. One big one is that these they're not capable of creativity or improvisation, sort of outside a very narrow structure. And you've really argued against that myth, right?
Right. In my first book, Extraordinary People, I wrote that savants were not very creative, and I was wrong. And the reason that I was wrong was because I had at that point, an early single snapshot of the savants. But now that I've been able to follow them for a number of years, what I've seen is a pattern in all of them that starts with a phenomenal ability to recollect, to remember, whether it's remember a piece they've heard or remember a scene from the helicopter or memorize books. They have this tremendous recollection. But then if you follow them long enough, they seem to get bored with their recollection and begin to improvise. That's certainly true of Leslie. He will, if you play a piece for him and ask him to play it back, he will dutifully do that. But after he's done doing that, he will start improvising and do variations on the theme of what he just heard and get a whole new concerto. And then the third stage is creativity. Producing something new. And I've seen this in artists who start with tremendous recollection, you know, fiber by fiber in an animal, for example, but then they begin to put a bush here that wasn't in the picture there, and pretty soon they're doing some freestyle. So there is this a movement from recollection to improvisation to creativity, and some of it is really as startling as the recollection itself. In other words, some of the creativity. Leslie, if you ask him to play a tune that he's never heard, it may not even exist. As some people try to stump Leslie by saying to play something that doesn't exist, he will create on the spot. He will create a song with the lyrics for that particular topic.
Well, that is very impressive. Would you say any of these savants, though, are bona fide geniuses? Would you say any of them, like, really could go down the history books as a genius? And is that possible for a savant to be like a historical genius?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, cool.
And there are some, I think, that may be on the way to that. There is a savant in Australia who got his PhD in mathematics from UCLA and is doing some work, which I think, you know, may push us farther along than we've ever been. Interestingly, his brother, who is not autistic, won the Fields Medal in mathematics. I think some of the savants that are into interested now in quantum physics, particularly, or quantum theory, may take us farther than we've been.
What makes them savants, though, as opposed to just people with high autism-like traits? Where is their disability? What's their disability?
It is autism, and some of them, it depends on, they may have very limited daily living skills. They can't manage their own finances. They may need some caretakers.
That sounds like me. I can barely manage my day.
I think Kim Peek, if he had, unfortunately, Kim died about 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah. But if he had continued, I think he would have. In fact, NASA was spending some time with him, and I think if there was such a thing as superintelligence, I think Kim was would be a candidate. On the other hand, he had to have help dressing himself. He couldn't brush his own teeth because of some motor skills, and had other problems with anxiety and so forth. So his autistic underpinnings were there, and that's true of some of these others.
Is that right, that towards the end, as he got older, Kim Peek started to be able to do some things that he wasn't able to do? Like, there was a clear progression and development of some of these, quote, neurotypical skills, like social skills and stuff?
Right. And I would put him on the same recollection of improvisation to creation spectrum, because when I first met Kim, he had memorized this factual memory, which was simply astounding. But as time went on, rather than just bringing up a fact, he often would make a pun or some kind of a wit or some kind of a connection, sort of like a Google-like connection. It originally, with Kim, if you said Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, he would give you the whole history of when it was written, first time it was played, and all that kind of thing. But toward the end of his life, I asked him one time, "What do you know about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony?" And he said, "Churchill." And I said, "I don't, Kim, I don't get it." He said, "Well, Morse code is for dot 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 is the letter V, and Churchill always had this letter V. Whenever you saw him, he was flashing the letter V, and so he was making the connection between." One time I asked him, "What do you know about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address?" And he said, "1410 Front Street." I said, "I don't get it." He said, "Well, that's where Lincoln stayed the night before he gave his famous speech. So that was his Lincoln's Gettysburg Address."
Oh. Well, you know, it seems like he was like a walking hippocampus. I mean,
yes.
Like, it just seems like he, you know, his associative memory, we all have ability for associative memory, but we don't peer into that. We also, like, have all these other brain networks getting in the way and inhibiting it, and it's almost like he was just having direct access to his hippocampus whenever he wanted. free reign.
Well, that's true. And many times his dad was able to be a kind of an interpreter, because Kim was so far ahead many times with these puns or associations that I didn't understand, or even his dad didn't understand. But he was, and they were instant. I mean, he would do this on at speaking engagements or other kinds of things. He would make these puns or these witticisms that were simply jaw dropping. And that's when you spend time with him, that's what you got in terms of trying to converse with him and trying to keep up with him.
Oh, wow. It's so interesting to look at, like, how much the brain can impact this stuff. A lot of people would say, well, culture and learning and environment's really important too. But in some of these specific cases, it's hard for me to wrap my head around how Kim Peek would have been different. What ways do you think his memory abilities would have been different under different conditions? Maybe if he wasn't nurtured as much, he wouldn't have been as good. But I don't know, like, what do you think is the role of the environment? It's not like a teacher taught him how to memorize. He doesn't do all these memory tricks, you know.
Well,
naturally,
it's a preoccupation, and the it's kind of a force as much as a gift. He has to read. Leslie Lemke has to play the piano. If he doesn't, he gets anxious, and John Sorkin, a quiet savant, he has to paint, and so it's this drive that is continually mining or digging within the area, and for some it gets to be sort of insatiable. I remember a calendar calculator, George Finn, who was able, with his twin brother, there were calendar calculators as well as other number specialists. And I, one time, he lived in New York, and we had a cable TV show somewhere in New Jersey, and so we had to travel by car from New York to wherever this was. And the conversation was just continually about numbers and dates, and it was almost exhausting by the time we were there, because everything just revolved around these numbers and so forth. So I think it is sort of an insatiable need to rehearse or to demonstrate the ability. Several of the acquired savants, like Tommy McHugh in England, or John Sarkin in this country, became artists after their traumatic brain injury, but they can't stop. I mean, they're drawing on the floor, they're drawing on the ceiling, they're drawing on, they just have to keep drawing, and it's this insatiable kind of force. And it's not so much a practice effect as it is needing to discharge this the need to draw or to paint or to compute.
Right. So you've proposed something called like genetic memory. How do you reconcile the genetic memory idea with this idea of the acquired savant?
Well, the acquired savant, I think, demonstrates genetic memory. In that these are ordinary folk who have a brain injury or a stroke or some central nervous system incident, and become expert in art or music or math where there was no such ability before. Tommy McHugh, for example, was a construction worker, basically, in London, who had a rather colorful life and in terms of in and out of prisons and that sort of thing, and had a stroke from which he recovered, but he had became a poet. I mean, if ever there was an unlikely person to be a poet, it was Tommy McHugh, and an artist. And he simply was drawing everywhere and anywhere. And so that ability had to be inside him prior to the stroke. He didn't learn that. He didn't learn how to draw or to become a poet. It just appeared after in his recovery. So it had to exist. And I think that those pockets of ability exist in all of us in a dormant capacity. The acquired savant taps into that. And the question is, where did Tommy McHugh's art ability and interest and come from? And I guess, from my standpoint, the only way it could be there is through genetic memory. There are these pockets of dormant capacity within all of us that are transmitted genetically. And so what I'm saying is that we inherit not just the color of our eyes or how tall we're going to be or even behavioral traits. I think we actually inherit knowledge. And by that, I'm talking about the rules of music, art, or math, for example, come.
Another possibility is that we inherit the ability to learn the rules. We don't actually inherit the rules themselves. We kind of like, where some people are more prepared to work. It's like a template or a skeleton, and they just, their experience fills it in, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that's possible, and I'm open to that. The thing that steers me away from that is the rapidity and the epiphany-like quality that these have, that appear, and they appear to me intact as opposed to rapid learning. It's hard to prove that or disprove that, but
right.
But I think I know that there are many people who feel that what is inherited is the scaffolding or the ability to learn quickly. But I've got some cases where this just appeared with such spontaneity and such intactness that it's hard to believe that the person learned that. And in some cases, for example, in math, they're able to compute prime numbers or do other kinds of formulas and so forth without ever having been exposed to them. Now, in fact, I've got some autistic savants who are able to, now that we have the typing tablet, and they have been mute, but they're now typing on their own on this tablet, who are typing out the periodic table, for example, never having seen the periodic table.
That is very impressive. Do you think the same thing is kind of going on with people with talents, just neurotypical people with talents, or I guess they wouldn't be neurotypical if they have an extraordinary talent, but I don't know, like people with prodigies, do you think a lot of these things are kind of similar phenomenon?
Yeah, I think I get a lot of emails that say I've got a son or daughter who, and then the parent tells me they're the story about the special skill generally that they've, because they've heard about savants. And many times it's difficult to sort out savant abilities from prodigy, from giftedness. I think some of these children are profoundly gifted. I suppose you could call them a prodigy. I don't know, but
prodigy officially you have to be before the age of 10.
Okay, all right. I think sometimes these profoundly gifted children or prodigies are difficult to sort out from autism. Now, if the autism symptoms are severe, the child is mute and withdrawn and obviously autistic, then you know it's clear that that would be a savant skill. But I think Daniel Tammet, when we did a program together, and he said that the line between genius and savant is a very thin one, a very narrow one, and I think he's right in terms of trying to differentiate those in terms of their ability and skill on the face of it. But it's an important distinction because if what let's say hyperlexia, a child who reads very early, we're talking about kids at 20 or 22 months reading. Now, some of those, sometimes the hyperlexia is a splinter skill. And as the picture emerges, it turns out that that child is autistic, but what has the hyperlexia is sort of his savant skill. But there are a group of children out there who are hyperlexic with autistic-like symptoms for a period of time,
right,
where the outcome is entirely good. So trying to sort those out is a real challenge.
Yeah, but it's also very important, you know, for gifted and talented education and our identification of kids who are falling between the cracks. Yeah, I think it's really important.
Well, it is, and I got an email just yesterday from a family where the child is hyperlexic and thought to be autistic, and the school was insisting that this child go to special education, which is exactly the wrong place for this particular child. Unfortunately, the parents resisted that and put them into a different educational system. And now I think the outcome is going to be, that's a whole another area of my work is what I call hyperlexia 3, which there are three kinds of hyperlexia. One is normal kids, neurotypical, ordinary kids who read very early. And then there's a second group where the hyperlexia is a part of their autistic splinter skill. But there's a third group called hyperlexia 3, where kids have autistic-like symptoms for a period of time, which they outgrow and go on to be very bright, contributing normal individuals. And the educational decisions that are made are crucial in that group of youngsters.
So what is this kid's outcome in the new school?
Doing marvelously.
Great.
In terms of growth socially, particularly, had been had a lot of trouble with was reading very early, and that was very striking, the hyperlexia, but language was slowed, and now in this first months in this new school, language has sort of erupted marvelously, as have the social skills in the school is. But the other school was actually wanting this child to, who was bored with math, you know, because it was way ahead of the curve, but they were saying, no, you have to go through the usual math sequence, because that's the way it is in the school. So it's crucial to sort those out.
I absolutely agree. And I'm really glad that you're making these points. I wanted to talk about, and I'm very mindful of your time, you know, but this is so fun talking to you. Do you mind having another 15 minutes or so?
Absolutely not.
You know, we talked about the acquired savant. Let's talk about the sudden savant for a second. This individual, Jason Paget, has gained a lot of, he wrote a book recently. And so I've seen a lot of interviews. I've listened to a lot of interviews, radio interviews with him and stuff. This guy got, you know, I think his head, you know, he got beat up, robbed, you know, his wallet stolen or something after leaving a bar. And he said he started seeing like numbers and things. Do you think any of these people are just making it up?
Yeah, well, he's not. Because I had him here for a lecture 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And had a chance to spend a lot of time with him. He was simply had no interest in math managed to sort of graduate from high school by substituting somebody else's work. And, you know, I mean, he simply was not an academic. He just didn't care about that. And then he ends up getting mugged and has this concussion and begins to see these strange images, which he had never seen before. And somebody said, as he tried to describe them to people, they said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Why don't you draw them? And so he had never done any drawing before either. And so he drew these out. And they're very complicated and very precise. It may take 2 weeks sometimes to complete one of these images. And he was sitting somewhere having coffee or something, and a professor, a physics professor, came by and he said, my gosh, you know what those are, don't you? He said, no, I don't know. Well, those are fractals.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And he said, you know, what's a fractal? And so then, and so he learned what a fractal is, and has become, he did go back to college then and is taking math courses and has become very expert, and he may be one of these people that lead us a little further than we've been in terms of when you hear him talk about relativity and explaining it and so forth and so on. So he's for real. I think there are some others where there are questions raised as to whether the musician, for example, really didn't have any musical training in the past. I have, I think now, somewhere in the range of 70 acquired savants that I've learned about, and they seem genuine and real. You know, their stories seem very genuine and real. There was this girl recently who was a ordinary person without any particular drawing skills or artistic skills, and she had a head injury, rather mild actually, but then began to do these pencil sketches, and she sent them to me, and they're simply striking. They're simply stunning, and she'd never done any of that kind of thing before. So what I'm trying to in terms of the acquired savant, some of these acquire a new skill, but pay a price for it in terms of cognitive ability or memory or other kinds of a trade-off of some sort. But I'm seeing more acquired savants now where there doesn't seem to be a trade-off. And I would put Jason into that category. And then I get other emails from people who have not necessarily had an injury, but have an epiphany of talent that just arrives on the scene, and they suddenly become expert in something or not expert. That's the sudden savant. These are people who, where there has been no central nervous system incident, and suddenly they are artists or poets or whatever, and that's even more unusual. But I'm seeing some of those cases now, and I got one, an email a couple of days ago from a young woman who had never. I mean, she was an average student, and she was, I think, in junior high school, and just woke up at one point one day and suddenly had this sudden urge and preoccupation with math that she had no interest in before, and now she's, you know, excelling in that area. Why that happened and on that particular day or what, I don't know, but those are the sudden savants.
If there is, as you've said, a little Rain Man in all of us, then, you know, what can the average Joe do without, you know, hitting their head against, a concrete wall, or, you know, to change their brain, or, you know, I mean, I know there's new tech, there's researchers doing transcranial stimulation, you know, trying to do that and stuff like that. What else can people do?
Well, I think there's all sorts of effort to make ourselves smarter.
Like coffee, for instance.
Exactly. Well, that, as a matter of fact, is the pharmacologic route, and the people have been experimenting for And coffee is a good example. It does work in the short run. And there are other chemicals out there now which will improve memory in the short run.
Or at least make you feel like you're smarter. Whether or not you're actually smarter is a different story.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It'll certainly it will impact demonstrably on memory capacity, for example. The amphetamines will make your memory, improve your memory and you can demonstrate that on tests, but it's not a lasting effect. So there's a pharmacologic route. And of course, if you watch any television now, no matter what it is, there's all of the metabolic products out there, the jellyfish that makes our brains better and work better. So there's this perpetual search for something pharmacologic. There's the technologic. You mentioned the RTMS. There is, in fact, Dr. Alan Snyder in Australia has been working with that in a very systematic kind of way. But there is, if you Google it now, you can buy these headsets that are available commercially to put on your head and stimulate your cortex and supposedly help. So there's that technological route. There's the pharmacologic route. There is the meditation and mindfulness route that taking a deliberate cognitive approach to expanding your mind or memory. I think the less dramatic route is simply to make some effort to sort of what I call rummage in our right hemisphere a bit and find a skill or capacity or interest that one can pursue, not necessarily just as a hobby or in your retirement, but to find out. A lot of people do find that out after they retire. They have an ability or they have something they've always wanted to pursue and now have the time to do so. And I'm saying we should get started earlier on that And that's a different, it's not a very dramatic kind of mind expansion, but I think it's the kind that works.
Can you become really good at something without any talent to begin with? Doesn't practice like matter as well?
Well, I think practice matters. And it matters even in the savants that the thing that with the savants, the musical savants, for example, as they train the talent and they get better by doing that, and so the fact that they can train it or develop it doesn't necessarily obviate the fact that it in the savant is just there, and sometimes there in a way that they haven't been exposed to. There's no question that practice effect can improve the skill, but that doesn't negate the fact that savants know things they never learned, and that's another that's another whole area. Of course, as you know, some people argue for the 10,000-hour practice effect, and give me a child and give me a bright child, or just give me a child who is, and the only thing he or she has to do is to learn music and concentrate only on that, and I will, at the end of it, have a prodigy or genius. And I'm saying, no, I think there is a substrate of talent that's distributed in the bell-shaped curve, that we're not all going to be little Michelangelos or Einsteins, but at the extremes, there is this talent, and I'm adding to talent knowledge of the rules of that particular talent that I think are inherent in.
So such an interesting conversation for me, and I really appreciate it. I want to end a little bit talking about your theory of mellow. How can we all be more mellow? And what are some other side interests or hobbies or things that most excite you today?
Right. Well, of course, mellowing comes from listening to patients through the years. And obviously, if you listen to, like any doctor in any specialty, toward the end of your career, you get more and more interested in prevention rather than treatment. You know, all along one wonders about how can you keep this from happening. But I think that the longer one is in a career, the more intrigued one gets with how can we keep this from happening. So I listened to patients for all these years and learned certain things from them, from listening to them. And I just put those together in a formula or a booklet or whatever you want to call it, called Mellowing. For example, being able to, well, first of all, my definition of mental health is being relaxed, at ease, and pleasantly convivial. And that's what mellow means, relaxed, at ease, and pleasantly convivial. And how does one become that? Well, there are things you can do, for example, to focus more on who I am rather than what I do, and not all of my identity, wrapped up in what I do rather than who I am, sorting out what I call the urgent from the important. That we spend so much of our times with urgent things in our life, and we ignore the important things like love and care and concern and interaction with each other. We get our priorities mixed up, and a variety of other kinds of things that are really common sense, but we don't pay much attention to our health until it's interrupted. Then suddenly it's like we don't pay much attention to sleep until we can't sleep well. And once your health is interrupted, then especially with mental health, there are things one can look at. So I've put those together in a little formula, I guess, that make us more able to be relaxed, at ease, and pleasantly convivial. And part of it's just getting off the treadmill that we end up on, some of which is necessary, but a lot of it are things that that we learn later on were not all that important.
This is really great, Daryl. I feel like I've gotten a lot of wisdom from you in lots of different ways. I mean, looking back, your very long career, what has given you the greatest sense of like meaning in your life? Has it been interacting with these savants, getting to really know them as people, as opposed to just doing scientific research? What is it? What are really some of the most meaningful highlights of your career?
I think the highlight has been not so much what I might have discovered or insights that I've had, but it's the effect that some of those insights or interactions have had on people and their lives, not only the savants, but their families as well. And the real compensation that I get at this point in my career is from the letters from parents or from, I got a long email the other day from a girl who was now 21 years old, and she was hyperlexic, given a diagnosis mistakenly of autism and treated in some ways that really was not. Anyway, she wrote me this letter of what it's like to have gone through that, in the hopes that I could share that with other youngsters or parents. The knowledge that I've been helpful to people. It's one thing to do your job well and take satisfaction in doing a good job. But the real satisfaction comes from knowing that that effort is appreciated. And so you get, I think at the end of a, I know Dr. Walter Kempster, who was the superintendent of Winnebago a century before I was, when he retired, his staff gave him a bunch of books, the library books, which in those days were very valuable. And he said, I really I'm glad to get these books and that I will treasure them. But he said that more important than knowing that I did the job well is that the knowledge that my efforts were appreciated. And I think that's true of all of us. And so my satisfaction comes from in small ways. I every now and then would go out and meet with a high school class of the advanced psychology students or whatever. I go to a little village near here called Oakfield once a year, and we get together and I do this lecture. And then each year they send me back a card signed by all of these kids, you know, how appreciative they were. And for some, they will say it's been a meaningful I want to be a psychiatrist, or I want to be a psychologist, or I want to be a neuroscientist. And I have a couple of kids out there now who are about to graduate from medical school, and they wrote to me and said, the reason that I'm in medical school is because of this lecture that you gave that I said I wanted to attend. And so it's that kind of feedback that, you know, it's not monetary. But it is the appreciation and knowing that you've had a really positive impact on these, and the appreciation letters from these parents especially are just really, really moving.
I know for a fact a lot of people will really appreciate you. I really appreciate you. And I've seen videos. I've seen you interact with these savants, many of these individuals who there's hardly anyone else in their life who really appreciate them, their uniqueness. And you kind of bring out of them, I've seen you bring out of them this kind of special, the expression of themselves that a lot of people haven't been able to coax out of them. So I think you've really done a great, great service.
Well, thank you. I think, you know, when I started the children's unit at Winnebago, we had these really disturbed kids and we started this unit and we started a school, and there weren't any models out there, so we had to create our own. And my motto, or I guess my strategy, was that look, no matter how disturbed this child is and how closed they are, somewhere in there is an island of intactness. And that's true of every psychotic patient or every depressed patient too, no matter how depressed, you know, there is this island of intactness, and our job is to find that island of intactness and to build on it, you know, to nurture it and to make it grow. And so it is with the savants that within them, it's easy with some of them, there's this island of genius that strikes. But even with some of the other kids that are really severely, or some of the psychotic patients that I've treated, I search for that island of intactness. Or even with some of the behavioral kids, the kids that are, you know, acting out and so forth, you're still. So I guess I have that. That if there's a sort of an urge within me, it's to search for that island of intactness, and no matter how disturbed the person is.
I love that.
And sometimes you learn from your patients, and that's what this mellowing booklet is all about. Things that I've learned, and some of the things are very obvious. I when I first became superintendent of the hospital, I put out a suggestion box, and I said to the patients, you know, I go home every night, you stay here. What can we do to make this a better place? And one guy put a suggestion. He said, don't serve beans on dance night. And I thought it was very practical and easy to implement. So if you listen, you hear things that you learn.
You are the savant whisperer. last question. What are you most excited about in the future? You know, it could be recent advances in technology. Can you be you personally in your own personal life?
I think the neuroscience frontier is I think we're, we have barely scratched the surface of the brain and its complexity. The more I've worked with it, the more in awe I am of this 3.5 pounds of circuitry and what it can do, and how little we really have been able to unravel about that. But I think we're now have some technology and techniques, not all imaging, but some other kinds of things as well that will allow us to, hope is that some of the things that I've been talking about, including the genetic memory kind of thing, somebody will be able to pick up and to prove. So that's what I'm looking forward to, and seeing some of these. I recently gave a lecture to a bunch of fourth graders in an elementary school. They asked me to come, and I thought, geez, I know how to talk to adults, and I, graduate students will say to fourth graders. And so I went there, and we just had a blast. Those kids were prepared for, obviously the teacher had prepared them. I said, Dr. Trevor, how come there are more male savants than female savants? I mean, these are fourth graders, raising that kind of a question. And at the end of it, a little guy and a little girl came up, and the guy said to me, he said, I want to be a neuroscientist when I grow up. And the little girl said, me too. And for me, the real payoff would be the day they walk across the stage and get their master's degree in neuroscience and their doctorate and carry on the work that I've sort of started or have been immersed in. And that to me is, that's where I'm drawing my satisfaction. I also, I've got a huge orchard, which I take care of, it's in full bloom right at the moment. And it's just, marvelous. And so I spent a lot of time on our property. We've got a beautiful waterfall on our property too. And so I can, soak that up just as much as genetic memory.
Please take a picture of them in bloom, and I can put it in the show notes.
Okay. I will.
Thank you, Darryl. I've really treasured this conversation and getting all the conversations we've had.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk with you and get to know you a bit better, and electronically at least. At some point, I hope our paths will cross, and I'll keep doing what I'm doing, and you keep doing what you're doing, and between the two of us, we'll move things ahead a little bit more.
Sounds great, Darryl. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next season for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.